Research. Hole in the Bucket is KBOO's show on housing, homelessness, and poverty. And tonight we have a special show, a solemn show. As most of you are also very aware, we are now sitting 1 year later from the catastrophe and failed response of the government to do anything after the natural disaster of Katrina. And the human disaster that ensued is still something that we're all very mindful of, but is particularly of great impact to the people in the storm-affected area in Mississippi, New Orleans, and probably the entire lower state of Louisiana. Tonight we have with us, I should say my name is Michael Anderson, and I'm joined in the studio by Jay Thumeyer.
Good evening.
And tonight we are very happy to be joined by Dionne Aim, a lifelong resident of New Orleans. She's lived there for 69 years, except for a five-year adventure that included stops in New York City, St. Augustine, and Charleston. Dionne is an ordained minister of the Baptist ordination and the Heritage Universalist practice. She is a holistic nurse who has been the past president of the American Holistic Nurses Association and a certified healing touch practitioner with a specialty in energy therapy. So, Dionne, are you with us?
Yes.
Thank you very much for taking time to be with us tonight. How are you doing?
Thank you. I'm doing well today. Thank you.
Welcome.
So, at Hole in the Bucket, our focus here is, as we stated in the opening show, about housing, homelessness, and poverty. There has not been a greater example in my life when these issues that are always existing on the fringes and the edges of our society have been brought front and central, what it means when you don't have the security of home and economic stability. And so tonight, we have Dionne, and we're going to talk a little bit about what is New Orleans like 1 year later? What has been the experience for the different residents of New Orleans, and how the differences between things such as race and class have played out in order to shape a lot of what we see as the current day New Orleans as we transition into the rebuilding. So, Dionne, I guess, as a place to start, could you tell us a little bit about yourself in terms of your residence in New Orleans, your involvement in the community, and a little bit about your life before the hurricane and failed government response, then talk a little bit about how things changed?
Well, I'm a native New Orleanian and have done most of my education here in this city and have, by and large, been here working, as you said, except for a few years on the road when I was a lot younger. But I've been here now and still do work part-time and have a part-time ministry as well. I'm one of the unbelievably fortunate people that lived in what's now being called the sliver by the river, the little original footprint of the city. If you take from the French Quarter and follow the Mississippi River upriver for about 12 miles, that was the original city. And that is the part that did not flood. And I live there, so my house, my personal house, did not flood. Though it experienced, like most people, exterior damages, which have been, by and large, repaired. So I have a house. So that's the first thing that's pretty remarkable in a city where over half of the population is still displaced and 80% of the city was in ruin. So we're a very, very small section that is up and functioning. Before the storm, life was like for everyone, pretty routine, content with friends and keeping up with the yard and life in wonderful, incredible New Orleans. I was one of the people also that evacuated prior to the great flood, having left town on that Saturday morning to seek refuge with friends in Texas, where I had to stay for 5 weeks because once the flood happened, people were not allowed back in. Because I still work part-time as a nurse in a psychiatric hospital, my hospital had evacuated up to Memphis, and they were back and ready to open and needed me to return, but I couldn't get here. So the first day that I knew that we could get back in and they would let us in, I came back. It was so strange. We had to pass by a National Guard station and show ID, and the city was on shutdown, and it stayed that way for quite a number of months. And so I returned and went back to work, and living in those first months were eerie. I mean, I think everyone has seen on the national news stories about the lack of resources, the decimation of the infrastructure. You know, we didn't even have grocery stores for many weeks. And those problems still are pretty pervasive in most of the city.
Dion.
So now if I just stay in my neighborhood, in a way you would think things were okay, but we all know better, because the vibration and the energy level in the city is just deeply, profoundly disturbing for everyone who lives here.
Dion, this is Jay, and I would, as a healthcare provider, I would really be interested in your reaction to this. There's an article that I emailed you by Bill Quigley, who wrote some excellent stuff. Speaking of health and healthcare, he says, quote, half the hospitals opened before Katrina are still closed. The state's biggest public health care provider, Charity Hospital, the famous Charity Hospital,
right,
remains closed, and there are no current plans to reopen it anytime soon. Health care could actually get worse. Dr. Mark Peters, board chair of the Metropolitan Hospital Council of New Orleans, said that within the next 2 to 3 months, quote, all the hospitals will be looking seriously at cutbacks. Quickly asked why. I'd like to hear your remarks about that. Doctors and healthcare workers have gone. There is a surging demand from the uninsured, who before Katrina went through now non-existent public health care. There is a shortage of nurses. Obviously, there's a shortage of professional healthcare providers like yourself. Can you talk about the prospect of opening the hospitals, and not just Charity Hospital, but that being the most famous?
Well, it looks as though the plan is not to reopen Charity Hospital, but to redesign a new healthcare system for the state of Louisiana. Part of the problem that was so pushed in everyone's face during the horrific first week post Katrina was the disparity in accessible resources of all kinds based on income and class. Mm-hmm. And so we had a private healthcare system, or one for people with insurance. Now, and then we had the charity system. Well, the elderly, many of those people had Medicare and were being treated in the private sector originally. So the charity system functioned primarily, not that they didn't have a tremendous amount of elderly people who preferred to go there because they'd been born there or their whole families had been there, were Medicaid people.
Mm-hmm.
And because it was the big trauma center for the region, you know, they had a lot of first-level trauma one activity.
Right.
So with that gone, everyone, the people that are here are just at a total loss for services.
One thing that really upsets me is he goes on to say that there is no hospital at all in the city for psychiatric patients.
Well, in the city. Now, you see, New Orleans, you'd almost have to see a map to understand it. It's a town is one thing, and then across the street it starts something else. So there's the actual geographical area of New Orleans, which was only around 500,000 population. Population has been going down in New Orleans over the last 30 or 40 years. I think the
highest population, we were around 600,000, and that might have been 20, 30 years ago. So we were around 500,000. But the greater metropolitan area was over 1 million. And that includes things in another parish, Jefferson Parish, which Metairie, if you're driving out toward the New Orleans airport, you pass through Metairie, and then you pass through Harahan, and you pass through Kenner. So these are all townships that just change name across the street. Mm-hmm. And then if you're going out toward the east, you go through New Orleans, and then the line ends, and you're into St. Bernard Parish, or we call them parishes, the rest of the world calls them counties. And you go through Araby and Chalmette in St. Bernard.
And then,
so if you look at that whole area, things are very, very different. The city of New Orleans itself, all the inner city hospitals, with the exception of one, were inundated in flood,
mm-hmm.
and have remained shuttered. Now, the big Oxnard Medical Institutions, which is out in Jefferson, has recently purchased two of these shuttered hospitals. The now infamous Memorial Medical Center, which I'm sure everyone has read about by now, with our Attorney General trying to bring suit against nurses and doctors who were there. Have you all heard about that?
Yes, we have.
Yeah, so Oxnard Medical Institutions, you know, one of the giant medical institutions of the country and certainly of the South, has just purchased two of these hospitals, one in Kenner and the big Memorial Medical Center. And they are planning on renovating those and reopening them, but that's a good year away.
Although Michael and I are familiar with the situation at Memorial, could you explain that situation for listeners who may not be familiar?
Well, Memorial used to be a Southern Baptist hospital, and eventually they sold it, and it became run by a Tenet Corporation based out of Dallas, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, one of the old uptown premier hospitals of the city. And they rented space in that hospital to other corporations for intensive care units and so forth, because the hospital was quite large.
Mm-hmm.
And when that area of town flooded and then was without all service, no electricity, no water, no way to get in or out, and ventilators were failing and people began dying, and it was days before there was even a recovery capability to come there and get people. And the charge has been that some people were given doses of medication for symptom alleviation that resulted in death.
Mm-hmm.
And so particularly they're looking at a physician and two nurses. It's had an enormous outcry from all over the country.
Right.
Most people profoundly in support of the physician and the nurses, you know, people who, first responders,
exactly,
who were doing whatever they could to try to alleviate pain and suffering. It's such an emotionally charged issue.
Yeah, absolutely.
That it's still getting a tremendous amount of press and a tremendous amount of response editorially.
Yeah.
I think 30-something people died there during the evacuation attempts. I lost a personal friend from an evacuation attempt at the Touro Hospital.
Mm. Very sorry to hear that.
Who was ill in the hospital at the time and succumbed during attempts at evacuation. So whether we've lost our houses or not, you know, everybody here has lost something very profound. And
right. Well, as a homeless show, we're concerned about a sense of place and people being able to retain their place, a place of their own. And I know that's a huge factor in the increase in depression and in suicide rates.
It's huge. The suicide rate, I think the last thing I heard was it's three times what it usually is, you know, adjusted for the population. So three times the suicide rate. A recent poll of people, 89% of the respondents commented on having grave difficulty sleeping and either depression or anxiety that's interfering with daily functioning. I work at a psychiatric hospital. It's in the town of Harahan. It's right on the other side of New Orleans, as I said, 10 miles from my home, which is uptown, but it's up the river a little bit. But it's a proprietary hospital run by Universal Health Services. And they have done a magnificent job. Over half the patients in our 100-bed hospital right now are indigent. Oh. We are taking people from all over. So, you know, we're not turning anyone away.
Mm-hmm.
But, we're not in the city proper. So when they talk about the city, I'm always concerned that they never mention the valiant efforts of this facility that is doing a yeoman's task of ministering to whoever shows up on the doorstep.
Well, and I think that's one of the subjects that we're going to really like to explore as the show moves on, is that in the vacuum that was created by a governmental response, all the efforts and, as you describe it, heroic efforts to deal and with the triage and do the best with what's available for the people who are still there. But I want to shift our conversation for a moment to talk about more specifically about housing. Certainly, this has been something that's been well covered in the national media, especially in the last week as we've gotten to the year anniversary. But a couple things strike me about the city of New Orleans. One is prior to Katrina, 53% of the residents were renters, which is very high for any city. One of the things that we're very attuned to here at Hole in the Bucket is that for those who are renters, many of whom are renters, having a place to call home that you can count on that's stable is rather tenuous due to economic limitations. To talk a little bit again, what it was like, who were some of these renters before Katrina, and what has happened in your estimation to those folks now?
Well, because we did have such a high rental population, and of course, there would be more African-American renters because our population was 67% African-American in the city. So it would stand to reason that if looking at percentage, you're going to have a greater number of that community renting. But there was a tremendous number of homeowners in the Ninth Ward. I don't have the exact statistics, but a very, very high percentage of the homes that were totally flooded out in the lower Ninth Ward, the faces of people many of whom you saw at the Superdome in the flood and walking through the water, those people lost homes that had been in their families for several generations. So, and then they're the largely white or areas of Lakeview, which were totally ruined, and Gentilly, which was a very racially mixed middle class neighborhood, professional neighborhood. All those places are gone, as well as the whole center of the city. So it's affected everyone, not just a particular race or class. The problem is there is no appropriate rental market in the city right now. The few things that were here that were for rent, I regret to say, have been prices have been pushed up to outrageous proportions.
I read a 39% increase on average.
Oh yeah, yes, and in many cases more. Right. So, people are desperate for affordable housing. There are great arguments still underway as to the recommendations of HUD and the local housing groups as to which of the public housing project units should be demolished and which should try to be rehabbed.
Well, isn't that prime property adjacent to the French Quarter, where those public housing projects are located?
Yes,
with 5,000 units?
That project, the Iberville project, I was just reading, I think, in the paper this morning, has approximately half of those units are occupied right now.
Mm-hmm. Or occupiable.
Yeah, there, and because they were not flooded, and others are being renovated, and so that's being worked on. And yes, there are, of course, developers who want to do all sorts of things. And I can honestly say that I and most people that I know are very worried as to what the outcome of this is going to be. Because in spite of the fact that there are enormous amounts of groups, Common Ground, Habitat, Nazarene Disaster Response, Operation Nehemiah, many, many names, Operation Blessing. There's a whole list of groups that are working on housing issues, gutting, repairing, debris removal. That is encouraging, but it's the coordination of it. It's like, you know, a good example, our mayor has a plan of called the Journey Home Plan. The state has a plan called the Road Home Plan. And there are some pretty legendary difficulties that everybody talks about between the state legislature and mayor and the mayor. You know, the governor and the state, and then there's the mayor and the city council, our newly elected city council. Mm-hmm. So I feel disheartened at times because it seems that answers are so slow in coming, and almost everyone that I know was completely devastated and ruined. I have very few friends that weren't totally wiped out.
I'm reading again in this Quigley article relating to that not a single dollar in federal housing rehab money has made it into a hand in Louisiana of the roughly $100 billion plus that's supposed to have been reallocated and allocated to rebuilding the Gulf Coast area.
Right.
Though Congress has allocated nearly $10 billion in community development block grants, the state of Louisiana is still testing the program and has not yet distributed dollar number one.
That's right.
Along with that, a group called Corp Watch says in a recent report, quote, many of the same disaster profiteers and government agencies that mishandled the reconstruction of Afghanistan and Iraq are responsible for the failure of reconstruction of the Gulf Coast region. That similarity is something that that really galls me as far as the part of the government response, quote unquote.
It's angering. It's frightening. You know, the money hasn't filtered down yet because the mechanisms are all still so unclear. Many people are still in profound arguments with insurance companies as to whether damages were caused by flood or caused by wind damage. So neither of the policies want to pay. So there's once again, you know, the attorneys are doing pretty well, because there's so many lawsuits and so many things tied up in litigation. And, you know, if you look at the bureaucratic response, it is, as most bureaucracy issues, overwhelming, top-heavy, too expensive, and too inefficient.
And retarded.
And totally retarded.
We have to, at this point, take our break. We'll have a music break for a few minutes and then return. We're speaking with Reverend Dion Aim, and we really appreciate your being here. But we'll have a brief music break and then be back. This is KBOO at 90.7.
All right.
Welcome back. You are listening to Hole in the Bucket on 90.7 FM, KBOO, your community radio. That was John Coltrane, and we are tonight on Hole in the Bucket talking about New Orleans and the Gulf Coast 1 year later. And we're joined from New Orleans with Dion Aim, Reverend Dion Aim, and so we're going to open up lines to callers. We know that there's a number of people that we talked to who may or may not be able to call in tonight who did some work down in New Orleans and others in the community over this past year. So if you did and you want to join our conversation, the number is 503-231-8187, and now we'll get back to our conversation.
Reverend Aim, I would like to focus on children. I've got something really impressive here about going through the streets, and everywhere is silence. It was the silence of missing kids, quote unquote. New Orleans had 128,000 children before the storm. No one knows how many have now returned, but just 18% of public school students were back by the end of the school year. With families still trickling home, mid-range estimate has the schools reopening with 38% of their old seats filled. Of course, teachers have had difficulty returning because of the condition of their houses and other services. Extrapolating to the child population as a whole, that would mean more than 80,000 children are still gone out of 128,000. What I'm interested in is a term called parentification, which basically is children absorbing the grief of their parents. the confusion and the disorientation of their parents. Can you speak to that, please? What you've seen, witnessed among children dealing with that?
Well, I know we have a child and adolescent unit at the hospital in which I work, and there has been a marked increase of depression among children, in addition to the oppositional, defiant behaviors and ADHD and other things like that. There is such a poverty of resources available to approach these problems. We are encouraged with that. Some of the things that the storm has blown away needed to go. One was probably the worst school system almost in the country, mm-hmm. that had been mired for years in graft, corruption, and mismanagement. So now we have several different systems, many new charter schools, and I feel that that's very positive. So they started with all new faculty. I mean, people all had to go through application processes and start over. Everybody didn't just, even those that were here, teachers that had come back, it wasn't just you're going to automatically get your job back.
I'm confused about the kind of changes
that can be affected by that are going to take a while to happen.
I'm confused about the charter schools. Do they reach all students regardless of income level?
Yes.
Great.
It's a management designation.
I see.
In other words, they're not under a centralized school board. Right. You see, and the school board isn't really under the mayor. Mm-hmm. They're like a freestanding entity. I don't totally get it myself, and I've lived here my whole life.
But the potential for real worthwhile innovation is
yeah, and so the charter schools are, you know, independent. Some are sponsored by universities and other kinds of groups. So they have their own management, their own board of directors, and they're available. So there is now choice.
Right.
You know, it's not just the neighborhood that you're in. People can shop and choose for the school that's best for their child. But many people whose children were in terrible failing schools and who were doing poorly in schools, who have been absorbed into Houston and Baton Rouge, Atlanta, are three of the biggest areas, though we have people throughout the states, are finding that you always read accounts of people saying that the child is doing so much better, that they're, even though they desperately miss home, they're trying to put down roots in these different places. So it's probable that New Orleans will be seeding new communities all over the country.
Sounds good.
As people find it very hard to get back.
It's difficult for people to appreciate how many people are still displaced in Texas and Atlanta, for example. I'm reading in Texas, for example, the Houston officials say their city is still home to about 150,000 storm evacuees.
Right. We have over 200, and I'm just talking New Orleans now. I'm not talking the people from Metairie that also there was a lot of flooding in parts out there that are gone. St. Bernard is their population's down 80%.
Mm-hmm.
But we have 250,000 New Orleanians out of 500,000. And then the greater metro away. And, you know, you talked about home and how do renters find home, and I mean, I really resonated to that. What was home to the renter was the larger community.
Mm-hmm.
And even though they're rented, there is something so remarkably unique about this place, this city. It's history. I mean, you know, people talk about the music and the food, but it's more than that. It is truly a way of life and a mentality and a feeling and expression that was unique. So even if people moved every 2 months, they didn't have a homestead, but they had the larger home, and they related to the sense of larger home, and that is what is so profoundly disruptive now.
Right. I've read that repeatedly. It's not the music and the food. It's the neighborhood that's missed the most.
And the neighborhood,
their old community.
You know, in fact, they're even named. We have that was done, I think, during Maya Moon Landrieu's time, where all the different neighborhoods were identified with different name designations. I think there's 72.
Wow.
Neighborhoods, Black Pearl, Gentilly, Uptown, Garden District, on and on.
I was curious. I remember that speaking of neighborhood, the community that David Duke was part of was famously refused to admit African-American folks fleeing the surge. What could you talk about that? That specifically, I was a little confused by that. I wasn't sure exactly what part of the greater New Orleans area that was.
No, he lived out in Metairie,
mm-hmm. which would be southeast.
He didn't live in New Orleans.
Okay, so you don't.
From a neighboring.
You don't
town.
Claim him, huh?
We don't claim him. Thank you very much.
Right. So.
You know, but really, the main thing, though, that really must be mentioned is that for all the governmental nonsense, for the fact that Congress still refuses to hold the Corps accountable for the engineering errors that caused this problem, they're working to build new levees, but they're very far behind. They don't even have them back to the level they were pre-Katrina, let alone to Category 5 status. And it's the sense of account of real, the government's total acknowledgement that this was an engineering mishap, more than a mishap.
Well, it's criminal.
Engineering
neglect.
Folly. And I don't think that Congress is holding their feet to the fire in the way that it has to happen. So the whole country needs to know that and needs to put pressure on their elected representatives to take care of that piece of the puzzle. We are profoundly grateful and awash, really, in the love and gratitude of the outpouring of goodness from this country, in the interest in people such as yourself, in all the people that have come down here on their own time, at their own expense, to do the filthy, dirty work of gutting out moldy houses for people as a gift. There is no way to say thank you for that, except to know that it shows once again in a very dramatic way the great interconnectedness of people.
Yes,
and that we are really one in ways that I don't even think we can wrap our own minds around, but we're so grateful for that. There are so many volunteers in the city right now.
It's always upsetting to me to see Bush constantly reiterate how the American spirit is this resilience and this common concern is revitalizing New Orleans and responding to this crisis. In other words, he's exploiting that for his own benefit, when the reality is that the American people really are responding to this. It's a huge example of American community, and it's really pretty inspiring, to say the least.
If we could fire the government, we could be better off. It's almost like it is so, everything is so totally mangled,
yeah,
that it's going to have to, I guess, implode completely before something new could rise up. I have no idea how that's going to happen. The problems here are so complex that no one person or one group of people has a handle on it. We all see, it's the old described elephant.
Mm-hmm.
And if you sat down and read a week's worth of papers cover to cover, you're so dizzy by the time you've done that you just cling to you know, to whatever you can to find a center and a balance and a ballast in that. And I mean, I'm reading everything constantly. Thank God for Bill Quigley, who's a tireless advocate in this community, and despised by many and adored by many, because he is such a wonderful, outspoken, fearless champion of people. I'm very grateful that he's still doing that work.
He's certainly articulate.
Gianna, I want to turn back for a moment. I was really appreciating some of your eloquence about the character and what made New Orleans home, the neighborhood, the people. Well, among the many things that were so tragic was that as the evacuations happened, as the waters rose, particularly people who were in jeopardy were some of our seniors.
Oh.
And you know that when you think of the richness of a social fabric, that often entails at the very essence the contributions that people have made over their lives, and especially as they get to that later age, they may be forgotten to a certain extent, but their contributions make everything that we know, whatever community you live in. Talk a little bit about the loss of what I must assume would be many people who are community standards, community stalwarts for years and years, and some of that that vacuum.
I was looking at one of the news programs yesterday, and they were putting the list with the ages of the people who died in the storm. They would run it, you know, on the side of the program. And I was reminded again how many of those people were over 70. And so many, 88, 92, 78, very, very elderly people. Many of those people had already been marginalized because they were homebound, elderly, or they were in facilities of some sort. But many of them were still totally active role models, particularly in churches. It seems that the church, you know, Southern people are big on church. And there'll be some neighborhoods where there's a church every two blocks, maybe the same denomination, but a little bitty church with maybe 50 people in this one and 100 people in that, and then there are the big mega churches with thousands, of course. But we have thousands of churches here, and that is the lifeline of the community and the involvement, particularly for the elderly. And where people have a place of respect and continued involvement in the community. As a nation, we have been reminded that we do a horrible job of caring for seniors.
And disabled.
And the Medicare program is constructed to do, exotic interventions and health cares. I mean, you can get a heart transplant, but you can't have a home health aide to come help you take a bath.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, how sick is that?
Mm-hmm.
I did home health for 15 years up until about 2 years ago when I just, because of, age and other things, it was just getting really very difficult for me to continue to work out in the community. In this city, as I used to say, jumping puddles and dodging bullets. You know, we have just an appalling gang problem here, as all big cities do. But ours is exacerbated now by the devastation.
Right.
And so those elderly people, I see their faces. We saw them. We saw them at the Superdome. We saw them at the convention center. We saw them dead in wheelchairs. I mean, we're all haunted by those images. Hmm. And now so many of those people are gone because their houses are gone. And a lot of the people died after they evacuated.
Yes, that's something that I wanted to know. You know, for oftentimes for people who, for whatever reason, be it that they're advanced in age and beginning to have health problems, or they have other disabilities or other things that make them vulnerable, you know, one of the things that we really key on in this show is when you take away the stability of home, be it the home, the roof over your head, or your neighborhood and your community, that is so deeply unsettling that can be a fatal.
It is the death knell. I mean, first when you, the words of the big first piece is when they can't get out of the house anymore, either on public transit or if they were able to drive and had a car, the keys are taken away. And once they're homebound and isolated, it's almost like the beginning of the end for many people. I certainly don't think that institutionalization is an appropriate answer, but I've seen firsthand that trying to have people living alone in apartments and houses without some system to help on a daily basis, help them with their hygiene and meals and stuff, is cruelty beyond belief.
Yes. And I think that's one of the things, you know, that as Jay and I were preparing for the show, we both wanted to give our listeners here an opportunity to find out more and to really think on and meditate on the reality of what happened in post-Katrina in the Gulf Coast area, but also to think about, you know, sometimes a horrendous event like this gives you a very sobering opportunity to look in the mirror. And
absolutely.
I think when you look at the folks who are impacted as the floodwaters rise, as the evacuation did or did not happen, you know, it is those same folks that in any community, as you described, are already just teetering on the edge of what anyone would consider a decent life. And I think it's a calling for all of us when I think of what are things that can grow out of this, what are some hopeful strains. You know, one thing that we really need to come to reckoning with in this country, especially as we see the baby boomer generation come to their golden age, is that we do not have a system in this country that is prepared to help people age humanely, particularly those without resources.
Well, no, we don't. And, you know, we must renovate what we call our healthcare system. It's not really a healthcare system. I don't really know what you'd call it. It's in such a shambles. This country loves to pride itself on its accomplishments and call this one of the great healthcare systems of the world. It's not so. I've been a nurse for 48 years. I've seen a lot. I've borne witness to more horror than I care to even talk about. It's unspeakable. We've got to have a national health care program. I mean, we just have to.
I agree.
We have to have access to health care for everybody. We have got to have suitable living for people. Not in nursing home institutions. First of all, we have to deal with the fact that aging and then death is a very natural part of life, and we shouldn't try to avoid it at all cost. And I think if we could spiritually and philosophically grapple with that piece of the puzzle somehow, the other stuff might flow from that, Michael. I don't know. It's like when you see grandstanding treatments being done to frail, sick, weak, debilitated people with cancer, instead of finding a way to help them have a peaceful, loving, and nurturing ultimate death, it's cruel. We tortured the elderly to death in the last few years of their life. We totally ignore the children. They're just a pitiful, brutalized class by this country. And then we torture the elderly people to death. What kind of a statement is that on a society?
Yeah,
it's horrifying. And then there are people like you and your parents, whom I'm deeply privileged to know, and many other people who devote their lives to trying to change it. And we just have to continue to try to do that, but and raise the consciousness every possibility and acknowledge that death is okay.
I liked what you said earlier, especially about we need to stop. Well, one thing I'm very conscious of is the divorce between our so-called leadership in the government, who are pushing for tax cuts for the rich, elimination of the estate tax, in other words, the revenue sources for Medicaid, Medicare, all these, the safety net. Instead of accepting that, we have to solidify our efforts to displace those people and replace them with people who respond to the needs of the people, wherever it is, whether it's universal health care, affordable housing, whatever the need is. And I think Katrina really dramatizes the distance between our government and the community of American people who have the needs and who want to address them.
Well, New Orleans became, we were the poster child, if you will, for the classism in this country and the racism and the poverty and the maldistribution of the great resources that we have. Mm-hmm. But it's not just a problem in my town. I mean, it's everywhere in this country.
Certainly.
It's like we're building skyscrapers on a very, very poor philosophical structure, I think.
I think that's extremely well said. Well, we're about to the end of our program. Dion, I cannot thank you enough for taking time, especially right now around the anniversary. I think Jay has one more quick comment, then I'm going to thank you and say good evening.
Yeah, just very briefly, the United Nations has blasted the U.S. response to Katrina. The U.N. Human Rights Committee in Geneva accepted a report from Special Reporter Arjun Sengupta, who visited New Orleans in fall of 2005 and concluded, quote, "The committee remains concerned about information that poor people, and in particular African Americans, were disadvantaged by the rescue and evacuation plans implemented when Katrina hit the United States and continue to be disadvantaged under the reconstruction plans." And the comparison is with the response to the tsunami the worldwide response in comparison to the meager response to Katrina in our country. And that, to me, is pretty dramatic.
Well, and I think it speaks to what, Dion, you were saying, is that we live in a country that has many things that are great, but we have a great folly of also trumpeting things that we believe we do well, but perhaps if we looked more coldly and honestly, we would find a long way still to go.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm getting a sign from our engineer now that I need to wrap it up. So once again, let me please thank you for being on the show. And from here from Portland, Oregon, our hearts and minds are very much have you and your fellow residents of New Orleans and all the surrounding areas in mind. And we hope to take your struggles and lesson and not let it happen in vain. Try to address some of the underlying causes. So thank you very much.
Thank you for being with us. Thank you for caring
and for continuing to do the work to bring about the change we know must happen. God bless you.
Yes, thank you.
You too.
All right. Well, this has been Hole in the Bucket. Good evening. And we have DJ Audio coming up next. This is 90.7, your community radio station. And we are about to say good night. I'm getting a little grimace from the engineer, but here we go. Keep on rocking.